Penguin Random House Audio presents Blue Sisters by Coco Mellors. Read for you by Kit Griffiths.
For Daisy, for being there from the beginning. And for Henry, for promising to stay until the end. Prologue. A sister is not a friend. Who can explain the urge to take a relationship as primal and complex as a sibling and reduce it to something as replaceable, as banal as a friend? Yet this status is used again and again to connote the highest intimacy. My mother is my best friend. My husband is my best friend. No. True sisterhood, the kind where you grew fingernails in the same womb, were pushed screaming through identical birth canals, is not the same as friendship. You don't choose each other, and there's no furtive period of getting to know the other. You're part of each other, right from the start. Look at an umbilical cord, tough, sinuous, unlovely yet essential, and compare it to a friendship bracelet of brightly woven thread. That is the difference between a sister and a friend. The eldest of the Blue Sisters, their leader, is Avery. She was born wise and world-weary. At 4 years old, she returned to their parents' Upper West Side apartment after walking herself home from kindergarten, and declared herself too tired to go on. But she did go on. She always has. Avery taught all the sisters how to swim the front crawl, how to make friends with the bodega cats by tickling them under the chin, how to shuffle cards without bending the corners. She hates authority, but loves structure. She has a photographic memory. In high school, she broke into their school's records and memorized her entire grade's social security numbers, then spent the remainder of the semester freaking kids out by referring to them by their 9 digits. She graduated from high school at 16 and completed undergrad at Columbia University in 3 years. Then, she ran away to join an anarchic, non-hierarchical, consensus-driven community, otherwise known as a commune, before briefly living on the streets of San Francisco, where she smoked and, eventually, shot heroin. Unbeknownst to anyone in her family, she checked herself into detox a year later and has stayed clean ever since. Afterward, she enrolled herself in law school, where she finally put that memory to good use. They say you don't know your principles until they become inconvenient to you. And Avery is proof of this. She is deeply principled and often inconvenienced. She might have liked to be a poet or a documentary filmmaker, but she is a lawyer. Now 33, she lives in London with her wife, Chitty, a therapist 7 years her senior. She has paid off all her college loans and owns furniture that cost almost as much as her tuition. She does not know it yet, but in a few weeks, she will implode her life and marriage in ways she didn't think possible. Avery would like to be all backbone, but she is tender flesh, too. 2 years after Avery was born, their parents had Bonnie. Bonnie is soft-spoken and strong-willed. Her language is the language of the body. By 6, she could walk on her hands. By 10, she could juggle 5 tangerines at a time. She tried both ballet and gymnastics, but she never fit in among that flock of flexible, feminine girls. When she was 15, their father bought her a pair of boxing gloves after she punched a hole in her bedroom wall, and she found her true form. Bonnie discovering boxing is probably how other people felt when they discovered sex. So this is what all the fuss is about. Bonnie worships at the altar of discipline. After silently watching her older sister's adolescent decline, she vowed never to touch a drop of alcohol. Her drugs of choice are sweat and violence. This got her all the way to the IBA Women's World Boxing Championships, the highest level of amateur competition in the sport, alongside the Olympics, where she won silver in the lightweight division before turning pro. Unexpectedly, given her sport of choice, Bonnie is the gentlest of her sisters. She can get ice out of the tray without bashing it on the counter. Babies and dogs trust her instinctively. She is a terrible liar. Though her body is like a vaulted oak door, her nature is transparent as a window. Now 31 years old, and in what should be her fighting prime, Bonnie has quit both New York and boxing after a devastating defeat in her last fight. She fled to Venice Beach, Los Angeles, where she took a job as the bouncer of a dive bar. Most people go through life never knowing what it's like to have a calling, one that asks you to sacrifice the pleasure of the moment for the potential of a dream that may not be realized for years, if at all. It sets you apart from others, whether you want it to or not. It can be grueling, lonely, and punishing, but if it really is your calling, it is not a choice. This is how boxing felt to Bonnie. And yet, right now, you can find her in some back street of Venice, collecting empty pint glasses, helping tipsy women into the backs of cars, and sweeping up cigarette butts, with no trace at all of the anarchic, iron-hearted warrior she was trained to be. Their parents wanted a son next, but after two miscarriages never spoken of again, they had Nicole, known always as Nikki. Of all the girls, Nikki was the most girl. She could blow a bubble as big as her head. She listened to teen pop into adulthood without irony. Her favorite hobby as a child was raising caterpillars to become butterflies by feeding them tiny pieces of squash. When she was 10, she bought her first underwire bra just so she'd be ready. She'd had 5 boyfriends by the time she graduated from high school. She liked to pick out a week's worth of outfits in advance, including underwear to match. She could apply a perfect cat eye with liquid liner in a moving taxi without smudging the flicks. Nikki was always popular with boys, but she had a knack for female friendship. She joined a sorority in college, a fact her sisters ruthlessly teased her for, but she didn't care. Her sisters were often busy with their own careers, and she missed them, so she made a family of her friends. If Avery was sensible and Bonnie was stoic, Nikki was sensitive. She was a carnival of feelings she never tried to hide. Sometimes she was the ecstatic swirl of a carousel. Sometimes she was a bumper car collision. Sometimes she was the still target waiting in the shooting gallery. She was born to be a mother. But her body had other ideas. After years of agonizing periods, she was diagnosed with endometriosis in her 20s. Though she died at 27, she was not a natural member of that club. She wasn't the lead singer of a band, and she didn't live particularly fast to die young. If you'd asked Nikki, she would have said she lived an extraordinarily ordinary life as a 10th grade English teacher at a charter school on the Upper West Side, 10 blocks from where she grew up. If it seemed a smaller existence than her sister's, she never saw it that way. She loved her students and dreamed of one day having a family. Nothing about her life portended her death, except for the fact she was in pain. A year after Nikki's birth, their parents tried one last time for
Sample complete. Ready to continue?